Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we salute the Minnesota Timberwolves and the New York Knicks advancing to the second round of the playoffs. We preview an awesome matchup between the San Antonio Spurs and the Minnesota Timberwolves, and we look ahead to the game sixes and sevens happening this weekend. From there, we shift to the W side. We got more preseason action underway. AZ Fudd makes her debut. Angel Reese makes her Atlanta Dream debut. The Portland Fire, Toronto Tempo, they've made their debuts. We talked about what we saw, what we liked, and what we're going to be monitoring. Stick with us. We're going to have a good time. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday, sir. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here. Excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Ready to talk some more playoff hoops as we turn the corner. And it's time for teams to get it done. And it's time to survive and advance.
Well, speaking of turning the corner, let's talk about some of these Minnesota Timberwolves drives from last night. Am I right? We have a series ender, Steve. The Timberwolves, a 110-98 victory over the Denver Nuggets. They win the series 4-2. No Anthony Edwards, no Dante DiVincenzo, no Ayo Dosunmu, no Kyle Anderson. No problem, apparently, in this win. So first, a major salute to the Minnesota Timberwolves for being able to pull things together, to be able to defend at the level that they were able to defend at for 95% of this series. For them to be able to find enough buckets throughout the series, especially as Anthony Edwards, Dante DiVincenzo, and what felt like 90% of the guard room going down by the time we got to this game six. They found enough. They get it done. I want to start with them. What stood out to you in this game six? And in general, what were your major impressions from this Wolves series?
Well, I mean, I think the number one thing you have to consider, especially going into this weekend of playoff basketball, elimination games can be odd. They can be weird. It can get spooky. Because you do have the scenario where you have one team who's playing the battle of the playoff series where, okay, we're trying to figure out all these things that we had to counter and attack and see if we can poke you that way. The other team is 48 minutes away from getting you out of here. And so they are sprinting. Mm-hmm. And you get to these moments where we just need enough of things to work in this and you're done. We don't have to deal with you anymore. I think we saw that display in the Minnesota game, in the New York game. But I think you have to salute the Minnesota Timberwolves for, again, raising their level in the playoffs. It was interesting because Chris Finch was like, hey, you know, he had an interview during the playoffs. And it's like, hey, guys, he talked about the regular season. Can we pick this up? We need to be better. And they were like, hey, we'll be fine in the playoffs. Don't worry about it. And then they lost to start this series. And Chris Finch was like, yo, you guys lied to me.
Lied to me.
And they were like, our fault, will lock in. And they locked in. And I think you have to credit the Minnesota Timberwolves. I start with Jaden McDaniels. I don't know if we've seen something like what Jaden McDaniels did where he called out the entire, and I mean the entire Denver Nuggets out by name and said, they can't guard. We're going to try and attack them. And then he and the Timberwolves did it. Like, Ayo Dosunmu came off the bench and dropped 40 points and wasn't even involved in the last game. Jaden McDaniels closed the door on the Denver Nuggets. So not only did he decide, you know what, Jamal Murray, you're absolutely not going to have a good time if I stay out of foul trouble. Rudy Gobert and me are going to poke at this you and Jokic two-man game all series long. But with no Ant, no Dante DiVincenzo, no Ayo Dosunmu, it will be me who does all these things to score the basketball to reinforce the fact that I said you guys can't guard. That's a stunning playoff moment. I just like you. Everyone should embrace this moment in history where Jaden McDaniels called his shot, defended his tail off, and then got all of the buckets in the last game. Incredible willing performance. And it's one of those things where you have to understand the spirit of a team. You have to understand the spirit of a matchup. And this Minnesota team can rise to a different level when it comes to the playoffs. They have a defense they can hit. They have an offense they can get to. And this was a matchup where Denver never was able to kind of put them back into the box after that game one. And so all the credit goes to Chris Finch and the Minnesota Timberwolves.
No, I'm right there with you. The Jaden McDaniels truthers are rejoicing on what this series was for him, what the "you can, none of y'all can guard" interview was, what the slight bit of antics towards the end of what was a game four with Jaden McDaniels and Nikola Jokic, him just smiling, embracing the negativity, what that was. And then, as you mentioned, closing it out with 32-10, and not just closing it out with 32-10 with three stops on top of that. Dagger jumper over Jamal Murray on top of all of that. Like, I have put you in a box. Also, come with me, pull up jumper, let's go home. That's what playoff basketball is supposed to be about. That is just fun. And so I think you are right to start with Jaden McDaniels and what he was able to do on both ends of the floor. I want to give a quick salute to Rudy Gobert for what this series was for him. 8-11-3 doesn't sound like much. The work that he did against Nikola Jokic in this series overall was astounding. Per Second Spectrum, with Rudy Gobert as the primary contester against Nikola Jokic, 27 of 64 from the field, Nikola Jokic, a little over 42% from the field. 51% on twos. And if you remember, Nikola Jokic converted nearly 64% of his twos during the regular season. So big drop there. 5 of 21 from three. That's not going to cut it if you're Nikola Jokic. And I think in general, as you talk about the broader scopes of what the Murray-Jokic two-man game was, as the series went on, you start to see Rudy linger a little bit more in the paint as Jaden McDaniels was trying to navigate against Jamal Murray. We're okay with conceding these pops if Nikola Jokic isn't going to make us pay consistently. And he ultimately was not able to make them pay consistently. Can I give you some numbers on what Jaden McDaniels and Rudy Gobert did against Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic in this series, Steve? Because, like, you felt and we obviously talked about it. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I believe you're going to, no matter what words I say. So, yes.
You know what? That's probably fair. But 42 pick and rolls defended by Jaden and Rudy against Murray Jokic. 0.87 points per possession on those trips. Well below league average. Well below what it was during the regular season for those two, as they were just the best two-man pairing in basketball. 49 dribble handoffs with Murray and Jokic. And as you know, Steve, we talked about it a bunch. It's not just always Murray Jokic dribble handoff. You have that pair with Aaron Gordon when healthy screening. And you just have a lot of moving around that. But either way, 49 of those. 0.7 points per possession on those trips. This is one of, when you talk about the overall skill level of Murray and Jokic, what they've been able to do historically in their time together, that's like one of the most dominant defensive pairing series that we've seen when you consider the skill level and the talent face. They deserve all of the kudos. Jaden McDaniels did a tremendous job against Jamal Murray in this series. Rudy Gobert did a tremendous job against Nikola Jokic in this series. And as we talked about this in the lead up, if there was going to be a pathway for the Wolves winning this series, it was going to start with what they could do against that two-man game. And for them to slow it down to this degree is massively impressive, and it's the biggest reason why they're here. I couldn't be more ecstatic. I couldn't be more impressed with what they were able to put together.
And well, so I think the biggest thing is – well, no, I just think the biggest thing is Denver was never able to have those two land the finishing move post-game one. They had their moments, their obvious pressure points, but it was not the automatics we usually get from those two. And I think, one, you tip the cap to them for delivering that kind of consistent play forever. You also tip the cap to Minnesota for poking at it. But you also understand how important it is for them to be able to deliver Jokic as a pressure point. I can post you up. I can drive. I can hit these threes. Jamal Murray's cooking. You look at Jamal Murray having the most consistent year we've probably seen from him in a very long time. And this is the result. You see Nikola Jokic having another one of these years, and this is the result. It's more, to me, a reality of what could happen versus, oh, this is broken to a degree. Two other people I believe should get shouts out from the Minnesota Timberwolves. Julius Randle, I think with the job that he was asked to do in this series, he did it very well. Didn't try to do too much. Did not shy away from trying to do things. Understood the assignment. Got some matchups, forced some pressure, made some passes. Thought he was good. Nas Reed, consistent. And like he just, once they started running pick and roll for him, they just sprinkled that in over the course of the games. It was interesting. And also, I think you, in particular, Nikias Earl Grey Duncan, need to apologize to Mike Conley. Because you believe, the Minnesota Timberwolves guard room is gone sans Mike Conley. And Mike Conley prospered in an elimination game. And I think you should tell the world that you're sorry for that.
I'll tell the world that I was impressed with the job that Mike Conley was able to do on both. Can I just say quickly on the Mike Conley front, the near block that they whistled him on was nonsense. Give Mike Conley the block. Give him the block. I start with that in all seriousness. But empty side two-man game with him and Rudy Gobert, mix again the floaters, mix again the lob passes, competing defensively. Again, the block that should have been, but the ref said absolutely not. I will pound the table on that.
Sure,
man. I will give the salute to Mike Conley.
Did you hear the knock on the door? It's accountability. It's right there.
Accountability. That's funny. Also, quick shout, Terrence Shannon Jr. coming off the bench, spot start in place of Ayo Dosunmu, and just attacked. 24-6 for him in this one. And Chris Finch after the game was like, man, we were trying to stash the dude in the corner. Clearly, he's just better with the ball in his hands. Like, well, yeah, we have that kind of athleticism probably. So quick salute there. I'm glad you shout out Naz Reid. Quickly on the Nuggets front before we shift to Spurs Wolves. You kind of hinted at it. This is more pro Wolves than like Denver is broken, et cetera. Do you think we'll see any sort of major changes from them? Or do you think this is just a matter of let's get healthy because we didn't have Aaron Gordon, we didn't have Peyton Watson, we make some minor tweaks around the edges and we come back stronger?
I mean, it's a tough decision to make because at the end of the day, they did not have health during the season and they rose above it, and they didn't have full health during this playoff series. So they just didn't have the Aaron Gordon that grew this year in this series. They didn't have the Peyton Watson that grew this year in this series. And so they had just had different combinations. And so I don't know if they go a full pivot. I don't know if I go, well, the Denver Nuggets window is closed quite yet. They do have some decisions to make. But I think that the toughest part for Denver is all of the attempts and the work that you did to try to have a level of versatility, to be comfortable with different, you know, adversities as far as we're going to try different defensive coverages, we're going to try different lineups. You don't get the payoff for that. So you don't have the firm answer that what we attempted to build did not work. And this is the second time Denver has kind of experienced this to a degree where health has just removed certainty from them. And the last time they stood firm and said, you know what? We don't have this, we don't have that, but we're going to stick with this and we're going to live with what we got and end up with them winning a championship. So I think it's more of a, there are things we need to tweak, there are things we need to add, but it's hard to argue that this team did very positive things. It's just they ran into the one team that was ready to fight them for six consecutive games. Denver, Minnesota is a rivalry for a reason.
Tim Connolly somewhere in his office just cackling at what this has turned into when these two teams face off in the playoffs with how he's built this thing. I think for me, if I had to guess what happens in Denver, I would imagine one of I would imagine Cam Johnson or Aaron Gordon is moved for something. If I had to guess, I don't have intel, but if I had to guess, that is where the reshuffling is going to come from, especially in light of Peyton Watson is getting paid this offseason. Like, you do not have time to wait on that. And so for the growth that he showcased during the regular season, he's going to be up for 4 years, 20-plus mil a year at minimum, if I had to guess. And so in order to make that work, and just historically how the Nuggets do or don't want to spend, if they're bringing back Peyton Watson, I think one of those two is going to be gone. And I just wonder, like, how they're able to reconfigure things. I think broad strokes, I'm with you. Like, I don't know if the overall window is closed when you have Jokic, when you have Murray, you just have a chance if there is any kind of relative health because of how good they are generally. But you look at what this series was and you look at even previous series, you kind of feel the athleticism gap between the two when you can have 6'9 Jay McDaniels hound your guard. And then with you don't have him, then here's Ayo Dosunmu. Or if you're going in years past, here's Nikhil Alexander Walker. They just have all these rangy guards and wings that they can run with. And then you have the physicality of Julius Randle, the versatility of Naz Reid, Rudy Gobert with his length, et cetera. And then you look at Denver, and just like, there's a lot of pressure on Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray to create a bunch. And those are like the only two guys that you have that can consistently win one-on-ones, they can consistently draw two on the ball. I think part of the reason why you make the MPJ trade to bring Cam Johnson in the building is so we can take some of the creation burden off of those two. And quick salute to Cam Johnson, who I thought as the series went on, really played strongly for Denver. So I want to give him a salute. Not that this series is his fault or anything. But it's just like secondary creation plus athleticism. I don't know if that means blow this whole thing up. I don't think it's going to be that. But I do think if you're looking at Denver moving forward, they're going to try to get more creation slash athleticism in the room so they are better equipped for matchups like this.
What's that mean? We always talk about which primary creation, secondary creation. What's that mean? Does the defense care about the person that has the ball in their hands? And I think when you look at teams like this, it's Nikola Jokic and Jamal Murray. They are always going to be the pressure points. They are going to be the creators because they will always make the defense react to a degree. Secondary creation, is that shooting? Is that driving closeouts? Like, do you want to have someone who's operating a pick and roll? Is that person just going to get drop coverage or switch? Does that eliminate the secondary creation? Like, we assume that, okay, if we get someone who's this, you need someone else who gets two on the ball to a degree at some point or some area of the court. Like Aaron Gordon, did he provide secondary creation by having the ball in his hands more and being initiator and scoring the ball more? Like, what does that mean to a team? Because the defense, if the defense does not cooperate, your secondary creation, does you end up in the same box, right?
Somewhat. Like, I think for me, it's less do you have like four guys that can draw two. Like, naturally, you would love to have that. I think if you look at OKC, if you're telling me on any given night, Shea can do it, Jalen Williams can do it, AJ Mitchell can do it against second units, et cetera. Like, obviously, if you could build a team that way, you can. More for me is like when the ball swings elsewhere, do you have guys that can just win those possessions? So it is, to your point, some of this is closeout attacking. Some of this is running secondary pick and roll. Not, you know, I'm saying, I don't need Tyus Jones to get two on the ball like Jamal Murray does. I need Tyus Jones to win his reps when he gets them so Jamal Murray doesn't have to run every single ball screen that they run with the Minnesota Timberwolves in particular. No Anthony Edwards. Did Jaden McDaniels get two all of a sudden? He didn't. But he did win those isolation attempts. He did beat closeouts. Naz Reid, similar deal. He didn't draw two a bunch. But if we run these handoffs for him, if we give him the ball against matchups, he wins them enough to where you don't need, you know, with Ant down, we don't need Julius Randle to give us 35 and 15 to have a chance. We have enough guys that can win those. For Denver, I think it's fair to ask, do you have the guy? Again, goes back to the MPJ trade. They wanted more of that on-ball juice from Cam Johnson. Not for him to be two on the ball, run 30 ball screens a game guy, but more so, okay, if it's not Murray and Jokic, do we have another guy that we trust can win some of these to take some pressure off? I think it's fair to say Denver could probably use another guy or two on that front.
So they scored the basketball? That's the secondary creation?
Creating shots for themselves or for others, yeah.
I don't think the game's about a bucket. So, I mean, what are we doing?
Yeah.
It'll
be helpful to have guys who can do that.
It's a make or miss league. You get the guys you got and hope they make the plays, and they don't, you lose. That's what happens.
Correct. Absolutely. That's the point that I'm making. But that's where I'm at with Denver. Again, salute to the Minnesota Timberwolves, who are going to be facing off against the San Antonio Spurs. No Dante DiVincenzo for this series or this postseason. Anthony Edwards, again, listed as week to week, so we will see if we see him at any point in this series or if Minnesota advances. Do we see him in the Western Conference Finals if they get there? We'll see what that part looks like, Steve. But during the regular season matchups, 2-1 series lead for the Timberwolves. There was no Wimby in one of the matchups. There was no Gobert in one of the other matchups. So not always completely healthy. And so heading into this one, Steve, what intrigues you about Wolves Spurs?
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny if you go back to January 11th where they faced off. The Spurs were the 2 seed, the Wolves were the 4 seed, and here they are in the last four of the West anyways. And so I think, number one, when you go series to series, you go matchup to matchup, there is an adjustment period. And, you know, there's layers to playoff basketball. And there's one team that can put you in a position to where you have to solve one or two problems very quickly. There's a team where you can figure it out and have an advantage over that specific team that you may not carry into the next matchup. There's a team that can present a game plan that can get you beat. It can be a blueprint for the next team that you face, or you might win and be completely free. So I think the one thing I want to say is matchups are important, but these things change from series to series. So you can be in a Hell in a Cell match in one series, win that, and now get back to what we saw throughout the regular season, because this is a different team that presents different challenges, which is why it's like, when we talk about, oh, these, the people who defend are so important, or off-ball defenders, or people who can't shoot, every matchup is different. It's why Dennis Schroeder has a game every single year. We'll get to that later. When it comes to the Wolves and Spurs in particular, this is a tough matchup to project in theory, because do we know when, if Anthony Edwards is going to come back? Are we going to get Anthony Edwards against Wimby? Are we going to get the rematch of the All-Star game where Wimby set the tone and Anthony Edwards said, actually, you know what? I'll also play. Let's do this. So that's where it's like, that's tricky. I think on its surface, the trouble for Minnesota, obviously outside of not having Anthony Edwards, who can just take whatever your scheme is and throw it over the top rope, the Spurs, like you had a matchup with the Nuggets where Jaden Daniels said, hey, these guys can't guard. You had multiple people drive and feel comfortable and confident and get paint touches and turn the corner and were able to get buckets and secondary creation. But the Spurs have Victor Wembanyama, and this is where things start to shapeshift. Nikias, are you going to be able to get those same looks? Are you going to be able to have that same comfort? Is he going to be able to disrupt what you want to do? Because as that Portland series went on, obviously he was out for a game, they were trying to move him around the board. He was getting more and more comfortable with, hey, I'm going to find ways to protect the paint and block shots. Like, if you look at the second half of game four and then game five, the amount of shots he blocked, he, as he processes in a series, becomes even tougher to deal with. I think that's something that gets underrated. So are you going to have the same level of offensive comfort that you had in this Denver series with actions you want to run, players you want to get involved? Is that deficiency going to be too much to be overcome? And I think if you're in Minnesota, if you don't have the offense clicking at a high enough level, defensively, you probably compete at a high level. I think you got to poke at the Spurs guards, but you have to find something consistent enough offensively, and that's where you need Anthony Edwards. I'm the Spurs. You need Wimby to do Wimby things. You need him to change the algorithm. You need him to have some fun with Rudy Gobert, and you also just need your guard play to be strong. And so we know what the Spurs formula is. The question is, if the Wolves don't have Anthony Edwards, can they poke at it consistently over a seven-game series? I'm not certain. But if they do get Ant, it gets tricky because Ant doesn't care. He's just going to take the shots.
He tall. It don't matter. I am still getting to the basket. I am still going to shoot over the top. First thing I had in my notes as I was thinking about this series is literally, did the Blazers series prepare Wimby and to a lesser extent Stephon Castles for this one against Minnesota? I was fascinated by Spurs Blazers heading in. I had Spurs in seven, and those second half collapses and Wimby being incredible said, actually, it's not going to take that long. So I'll take the L on that one. But I was fascinated by that series heading in because Portland, the healthy version, had so many wings and guards that can defend. And thus, it unlocks a level of cross-matching that you can tap into. And so we saw plenty of Tumani Kamara on Wimby. We saw Jrue Holiday on Wimby. When they went to the bench, you saw some Jeremy Grant on Wimby. And you would have one of Donovan Kling and Robert Williams kind of roaming around. Let's see if we can muck things up. We're going to dare your guards to win. We're going to dare your guards to knock down pull-ups. Let's have some fun with this. But as you mentioned, the Spurs were able to find some answers as the series went on. De'Aaron Fox, in the second half of that first-round series in particular, really started to pop off in this one. Stephon Castle, as he's being defended by Donovan Kling and other bigs, comfortable flowing in the pull-ups, finding different ways to drive, becoming a handoff or a screening hub and opening things up that way. The Spurs had answers, but they did have to navigate a little bit.
I'm going to add some layers to your rant here. They also inverted their offense and said, Stephon Castle, you just be a screener, buddy. Like, you do dribble handoffs. You run pick and roll. Let's operate that way. And then Victor Wembanyama, let's put you off ball. And so, okay, you might have a wing that you like on Wimby. Which one do you not like on Wimby? We'll go old school, the Lakers, Anthony Davis, go in the corner and we'll set a screen for you. And you decide how you want to go. Mm-hmm. So I think they are aware of what teams may want to poke at.
continue. And with that, I wonder, like, what the Wolves' attempt is going to be defensively. How often do they want to tap into that particular cross-matching bag? How often do we see Julius Randle on Wimby? We saw a little bit of that during the regular season matchup this year. Do we see that with Rudy Gobert roaming? If it is just flat-out Rudy versus Wimby, similar question with him. How did all of those reps against Denver, with Nikola Jokic ramping up his pick-and-roll volume to an insane degree, with Denver ramping up different types of off-ball screens to get Jokic catches on the move, does that prep Rudy a little bit for the myriad of ways that the Spurs are willing to use Victor Wembanyama? What is that battle going to look like? That part is going to be fun to me. And so, like, I am excited about what this defensive back and forth can be, and even flip it to the other end. Again, the Blazers were not able to score enough to make it matter, or consistently enough to make it matter in this series. But one of the things that popped for me, I believe, in game two, a little bit of game three, was, hey, Wemby wants to stay low. Let's see if we can go empty side, pick and roll, pick in the empty side dribble handoff. Let's drive. Let's not be afraid to get deep into the paint. Let's string this out. Let's force a late switch. And now let's get into a secondary drive. Is Minnesota able to tap into any of that, as they have better drivers, holistically at the very least, than Portland? Are we able to ding San Antonio's base defense a little bit? Because if they can, that at least gives them a little bit more of a pathway while they're waiting on Anthony Edwards to get back. And as you mentioned, Ant is just such a game breaker that it doesn't really matter what the scheme is. He can just score. But while he's out, I wonder how many avenues Minnesota is going to have. Like, also in my notes, just how often can they access the paint? Can they move Wemby around in the same way?
We talk about moving Wemby around as if he's not aware that teams are trying to move him around. And I remember a possession from the regular season where literally the Minnesota Timberwolves tried to move Victor Wembanyama around, and he stood and pointed to everyone to switch, and he stayed low. So this is the thing you got to remember about Wemby. You may get him one time. You may put someone on the wing. You may ding him if he's involved in the action. You swing it. Are you going to be able to do that 10 consecutive times? Are you going to be able to process and execute that action again? Is that going to be a thing that Wemby does not understand and recognize? That's where the Blazers series shifted, when he was like, actually, don't really care about this. I'm going to do my job. And we've seen this over the regular season where, you want to move me around the board. I will also move around the board to be where I need to be to make our defense as good as it needs to be. So, like, I understand the concept. You got the proof in the pudding. So, yes, it's on Minnesota to try and shuffle the deck against Wemby. It's very hard to do so.
Very much so. I guess I'll flip the question to you then. Do you see a pathway to Minnesota being able to score enough while Ant is out? Is that kind of a firm no for you based on what you've seen during the regular season and Wemby figuring things out in round one?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's a firm no. Anything's possible in the game of basketball. I just think you're going to have a blend of your defense has got to be strong enough to where you're able to run in transition, get some easy ones, and you're going to be able to have to find some comfortable enough actions where you have some movement, you have some flow. You, to your point, can move Wemby around the board, but it's not going to be one specific thing without Anthony Edwards. You're going to have to be able to swing and win matchups and drive and kick and try and have some tempo to what you're doing and some movement. It's going to take an effort. Like, this is where you may need Julius Randle to screen, pick and roll, switch, be able to win some matchups. You may need Jaden Daniels to get downhill in different areas. So there's pathways for Minnesota to score the basketball without Anthony Edwards. It's just tough for it to be something that's completely consistent because of what Victor Wembanyama does. But if you can find things offensively while you wait for Anthony Edwards to come back and you're able to guard them on the other end, you present a similar problem that you presented to Denver.
Understood. Steve, who are your X factors in this one?
I don't have any X factors. What you got?
Oh, boy. For me, like, I think on the Minnesota side, one, it's going to be a health thing with Ayo Dosunmu. Just, are you going to be available heading into this one? But beyond that, he looms pretty large in this series for me. Like, I think the pull-up shooting and the transition attacks alone are going to be important. This is very much going to be, broadly speaking, who can establish their defense first and who can put the other team in a box. If Minnesota is able to do that, then they're going to have to score quickly. Because I think it is going to be a battle, with or without Ant, honestly, to figure out how exactly do we poke at San Antonio's defense with the way that they can cross-match and with Victor Wembanyama lurking around. The transition game is just going to be super important in the series. I would assume we're going to play a big part. And within the half court, if we are getting Wemby in a drop, if it's Luke Kornet in a drop, it doesn't have to be 43 points off the bench like we saw in the high end. But I do think the pull-up shooting in general is going to be important. And so I start with Io on the Minnesota side. For San Antonio, I thought about Luke Kornet. I thought about Keldon Johnson. I kind of go to Stephon Castle because it starts, you know, similar to my base question. Like, I start with Wimby. Like, how did that first round series prepare him? With Stephon Castle, when Ant comes back, I would imagine he gets that matchup. How are you going to look there? Offensively, though, if we do see any sort of cross-matching again, similar to that first-round series, it is going to be up to Stephon Castle, still be able to access the paint, knock down enough pull-ups. As we saw in the first-round series, use him as a screener, use him as a handoff hub, be able to generate offense elsewhere, and be able to do that and not turn the ball over. Earlier in the year, turnover issues as he was working through things in the half court. In the calendar year 2026, where he became more comfortable as a scorer, intermediate stuff looked better, turnovers went down as the playmaking chopped up. We have been talking quite a bit about him just tossing it up there to Wimby on those lobs. That chemistry is there. But like against this Minnesota defense, even this version, they still have a lot of guys you could toss. You could toss in different ways. And so like what that creation looks like, being able to keep turnovers down so Minnesota can't get out in transition, he's probably where I start. A lot of different options for both of these teams, but I think that's where I am. I go Io and I go Stephon Castle. I think beyond that, is there anything else that intrigues you about this particular series? Like, I have like some general second unit thoughts about this one, but
what are your second unit thoughts, Nikias?
Oh, I think similar to the first round series with Portland and San Antonio, like I do think the benches can just swing things in here. When you have Dylan Harper who can get downhill and drive and play, make the way that he can. Keldon Johnson, literally sixth man of the year, his scoring blend, who he's going to be tasked with guarding at different points in this series, I think is going to loom pretty large in this one. Luke Kornet has been giving San Antonio very good minutes, an unsung hero in that first round series against Portland. And on the Minnesota side, we're talking a whole lot about what the creation is going to look like while Ann is out. Yeah, this is going to need to be a pretty big Naz Reid series. If we do see more Terrence Shannon Jr., they're going to need his drives and self-creation at different points. So I'm just curious to see like who's able to swing things. Is this going to be one of these second units comes in with first and turnovers? Is there going to be like a heavy offensive rebounding game or series for like a Luke Kornet? Like that part is intriguing to me. I think swinging the possession battle overall is going to be important in this one. All right, let's move to the Eastern Conference. As the New York Knicks, sitting pretty, waiting to see who their opponent is going to be in their second round matchup. But they're able to sit pretty because blowout win in game 5 against the Atlanta Hawks. And then if that wasn't enough, 140-89 against the Atlanta Hawks in game 6. It's weird to say that like a 51-point deficit doesn't really speak to how far away that game was, but it's like technically true. That was not the largest lead of the game. A quick question I have for you, Steve, before we get into like the more serious stuff. At what point did you know that game was over?
OG Anunoby starting 4-for-4. That's why I told you the elimination games are odd. I mean, he ended up almost outscoring. He had as many made field goals in the first quarter as the whole Atlanta Hawks team. But he came out on a mission. And so elimination games, a team can just present a different problem that you were not expecting to be a problem because we just need to win this game. That's all we got to do. And so I think overall, the Knicks being able to have the comfort of we feel comfortable guarding you. We feel we got off-ball movement back on board, so we can not only play through Karl-Anthony Towns, we can get Jalen Brunson off the ball, we can get some movement, we can force your defense to defend in a different way. We're no longer just going to be a one-action type of team. We're going to put pressure on you and continue to flow. Once they mastered that, they never really lost the confidence in that. You mix in the defense, continuing to get stronger as the series went on. Josh Hart really being active with CJ McCollum, Karl-Anthony Towns nailing his coverages, Jalen Brunson doing the best he could when they attacked him. That combination, you never moved the Knicks off of that once they kind of figured the Hawks out to a degree. So yeah, closeout scenario, and they just kept getting stops. They kept scoring, and they kept getting stops, and they kept scoring. Cooked!
Yeah, it got ugly very quickly. Like, my answer is not the first possession of the game, because that just feels incredibly rude, and that's very much a hindsight call. But I was worried first possession of the game. I was impressed New York, because I think, as you talked about on the Tuesday episode of the pod, once the intention level for the New York offense perked up, you could just kind of feel, ooh, Atlanta, you have to work really hard to put this back in the box, or you are in some serious trouble here. And I think if you zoom out, just the first three games of the series compared to the last three games of the series, you just felt the Knicks just finding more things they could poke at more consistently. And that got problematic. But first possession of the game, Atlanta has switched back to the matchups that we had saw to begin the series. Let's put Dyson Daniels on Jalen Brunson. Let's see if we can bother him. Onyeka, you got Cat. You just got to do your best, force out catches and all the good stuff. They immediately go to the Jalen Brunson off-ball package. Back screen for Jalen Brunson, back cut. It's like, okay, well, that seems problematic. And then they go back to Brunson off-ball, and they generate a good stuff. And then OG Anunoby has the wave, and the Hawks keep turning it over, and then missing shots, and then turning it over. And then very quickly, it's like, oh, well, I guess we know who's advancing to the Eastern Conference semis. So just a salute to the New York Knicks holistically being able to figure this out. And then just quickly to some player shout-outs. OG Anunoby, like, I don't think this classifies as a hot take, but I'll take it. I think OG Anunoby was just the best player in the series, accounting for both ends of the floor. Like, I think oscillating between Nikhil Alexander-Walker and Jalen Johnson in this series defensively, the shot-making, the timeliness of the shot-making that he was able to provide, super efficient scoring season for him, elite defensively, I'm just impressed with what he was able to put together. And for him to have that very loud Game 6 first half performance or first quarter performance, like, I think it kind of speaks to what he was in that series. So I wanted to give him the salute first and foremost. What you have?
Oh, hold on. Hold on. He averaged 21 points a game in the series, shooting 61% from the field and 56.7% from three. Yeah, he was really good. Continue.
He was insane. While we're here, OG was incredible. Jalen Brunson was able to find it on and off ball. I really appreciated the off ball usage from him as the series went on. As the Knicks were just trying to find different ways to poke at Atlanta's defense. So I wanted to give him the salute there. Karl Anthony Towns, like, one, you could just start with back-to-back triple-doubles. You just take that. But the way that he defended in this series, and particularly the last three or four games of this series, I think deserves a lot of commitment. The rim protection was there. The Hawks were not able to ding him consistently. And I think in order for the Hawks to be able to pull this off, I had the Hawks in seven, in order for them to be able to pull this off, they were going to have to make Cat uncomfortable. And I think Cat showcasing his level of comfort and proficiency defensively, in addition to, as the series goes on, okay, we see how we want to use you. We can mix in the handoff stuff. We can mix in the hub work. You can hit cutters. If they are going to have smaller guys on you, not so much heavy post volume, but he's comfortable shooting over the top of wings, or I can really get into the driving game. We really saw that in game four in particular. The way that he was able to problem solve as the series went on was very impressive to me. So I wanted to give a salute there too. Jose Alvarado had some moments, also just annoyed folks.
Hold on. Let's talk about Karl Anthony Towns. And let's build on what you said there. He took a grand total of 21 shots in the last three games.
Mm-hmm.
He had two triple-doubles in the last three games of the series. It's not so much that he problem solved. You got to remember, they were working to game plan to take him away. Let's put a wing on you. Let's put a big on you. Let's mix coverages. Let's make it tough on you. Cat's willingness to understand the assignment, know when to drive, them being able to play through him with the off-ball movement was huge, but he just kind of understood what was going on, and his ability to get to the free throw line as the series progressed, I thought was really important. So everyone's saying, hey, let's get him in the post. Let's do this. It's more so, okay, can I just be a consistent pressure point no matter what matchup you throw at me? And I think that's what he displayed over the course of the series, where I can have this impact. I can unlock our team's flow. I can mix in some buckets to remind them, hey, this isn't the best idea. And now you're guessing, as opposed to we're spamming Cat pick and roll. We're spamming Cat at the elbow drive. We're spamming Cat post-ups. That's where you feel like it was his most impactful series in the playoffs. And his defense was strong as the season went on. If CJ McCollum didn't have the I'm not a villain game, we would be talking about the two stops Cat had in the paint in that same mm-hmm. game. It didn't matter because CJ ended up sending them, you know, getting the win. But Cat was able to mix in different coverages. He was able to get more aggressive as the series went on. He was able to have an impact offensively. And so I think that's where you got to give respect to him. He shot 56% from the field. Yeah, but he averaged 18, 11, and 6. Like, it's not easy to do that. And so, like, I feel like a lot of times it's easy to kind of point at the loud mistakes that Cat may make or the loudness of just what Cat does play-wise. But the subtle ways that he impacted this series was very important. I just wanted to make sure I added that to that before you talked about Jose Alvarado.
No, that's fair. 19-11-6, nearly two steals, nearly two blocks in this series for Cat. 63-44-93 shooting splits, as you mentioned. Got to the line a bunch, nearly seven free throw attempts. Heck of a series for Karl-Anthony Towns, and they are going to need that version of Karl-Anthony Towns, regardless of who their next opponent is going to be. I have a quick Hawks question for you before we move to potential matchups, as that series is going to start, I believe, on Monday, since we have the Game 7 coming tomorrow. Was this a learning experience for the Atlanta Hawks? You just kind of build on this? Do you anticipate we need to flip something to make our roster more balanced? Like, how do you kind of soak in what this first round experience was for Atlanta?
It's a learning experience. They weren't supposed to be here. They worked their tails to get into the playoffs. They worked their tails to win two games in a series. But they traded Trae Young this season. They weren't necessarily supposed to be in this position. And so a lot of times when you're learning how to win, yeah, we know we need this for our team to prosper. So it may be having more size, maybe having more guard play, maybe having more defenders, more defense. But they built themselves into a position to attempt to have success in the playoffs that was not expected based on the start of the season, based on trading Trae Young. They were not supposed to be in this position. We can be completely honest about that. And it's a salute to Quinn Snyder and that roster for working themselves into this spot and having the success they had in the playoffs. So I don't necessarily know what the pivot is, but you at least know what we have can work. So what do we build around Jalen Johnson? What do we build around Nikhil Alexander Walker? What do we add to this group to take us over the top? There's lessons in learning in the playoffs. The playoffs are always the best teacher. The question is, are they going to try and adjust to what the Knicks did to them? Or are they just going to try to make themselves as best as they can?
I think that's fair. Like, I think for me, I lean more towards where you are, where I just take this in as we learn valuable information about these guys versus, oh no, this is a disaster. We got to do something because of what the last three games of the series was. I think it is important for the Hawks not to overreact to what the last three games in what the last game in particular was. That is just the salute to the Knicks. It sounded like a Knicks crowd by the time we got midway through the second quarter. Like, that is just bad. That just happens. Flush that down the toilet. I think for me, getting Jalen Johnson these reps as a number one, obviously a talented player. We don't have the All-NBA teams announced yet. It would not surprise me if he's on the All-NBA third team this year. All-star, all the things. I think for me, just looking at what some of the half-court creation was for him, it's like, okay, here's a growth area for you to take into the offseason. Let's see if we can build on that. Let's see if you can create a little bit better in these kind of tight windows. Are you able to get the spots a little bit easier? I salute Josh Hart for the job that he did against Jalen. OG, same thing. But like, you want to see that kind of thing. But the Hawks are in a fun spot because they have this versatile roster where they don't have like this monster like salary sheet. They're not boxed into this roster at all. They're getting the New Orleans first round pick this year. That's going to be a lottery selection. I think seventh best odds right now. So like, that is either we are adding someone really good and young to this to continue to grow this thing out, or if we want to get into any conversations about disgruntled stars, if you do want to go pivot on that front, the Atlanta Hawks can absolutely get into the room. They can have a phone conversation with just about anyone if they want to go star hunting. And so that's where, again, the ending of this series stunk, but the 2026 run for them overall was incredible. You got valuable learning experience here, and you also can just add young talent or a star talent if you want to do that. So, like, salute to what this Hawks run was, but wanted to get your thoughts on that front. Quickly before we get out of here, Steve, we do have a Game 7 happening. We got Sixers, we got Celtics. Joel Embiid, incredible. Tyrese Maxey, incredible. Paul George had himself a throwback game in this Game 6. And so we don't know what the result is going to be. By the time we pod next week, we're going to have the first round series. So if we do get a Celtics win in this one, that would set up Celtics-Knicks. What would be some of your base questions heading into that potential series?
Throwing that pass away. I just want to say salute to the Sixers for finding the blend against the Celtics that I thought they would find when Joel Embiid came back. And so you had the bad game one, you had Tyrese Maxey figure some things out, and you were decisive, and then Joel Embiid comes back, and boy, you got to deal with him in some sort of shape or your fashion. And so I think the Sixers present a different challenge to the Knicks to a degree. Now, would this be a better challenge for them to serve as far as being able to game plan against Tyrese Maxey with the size they have and the length they have? They're not as aggressive with help to a degree. Do we feel comfortable with our coverage against Joel Embiid? That becomes different than what Boston is trying to figure out on the fly to a degree. They can have a little bit more preparation there. So that could be a series where the Knicks are able to, okay, Joel Embiid is going to play this in pick and roll. We can attack this in a certain way. We can try and get Cat matched up or whoever's guarding him and attack that. We don't have to necessarily double Joel. We don't have to show all this aggressive help. That's not necessarily what we do. We'll be active, but we won't necessarily give them what Boston did. There won't be as many automatics. So there could be a different series there. If we're talking about the Celtics and the Knicks, it gets interesting because, okay, where do the Knicks poke at offensively? How do they get buckets against Boston if Boston decides we want to put a wing on Cat and we want to switch that? And now, yeah, we face that against Atlanta. That's going to be a different thing against Boston, who will be more aggressive with help, who will collapse in the paint. So that will be different openings, but that will be more pressure points for us to knock down these shots. And then we're going to have to guard them on the other end. And they're going to put Jalen Brunson in action. They're going to put Karl-Anthony Towns in action. They're going to put them in action together. So I think there are different challenges no matter who they face would be the larger thing.
Okay. No, I think that part is fair. Like, I think starting with Philadelphia then, one, again, impressive win. For them to battle back from being down in this series to tie this thing up showcases, one, just a baseline level of resilience that I think deserves some credit there. I think for me, if it is Philadelphia, I'm curious to see how much of this defense travels for them, because this has been, especially in the back half of this first round series with Boston, this has been a strong effort for them. I've enjoyed the off-ball physicality. I've enjoyed some of the nuance that they've been able to tap into. Again, I salute Paul George for the job he's been able to do on either one of the wings that he faces off against. So, like, what does that look like in a Knicks series that can poke at you in different ways? How do they want to handle the Brunson Cat two-man game? And on the other end, like, how often can you get Brunson in action? Because I think Jalen Brunson on Dyson Daniels in this Hawks series, a little bit different than you put him on Kelly Oubre, who I think Dyson is overall better player, but Kelly is willing to drive and finish in a way that Dyson Daniels isn't. Like, are you able to put pressure on him in different ways in that front? Like, that part gets interesting to me. And if we do get Boston in this one, like, I think we kind of know what the terms of engagements are in terms of the matchups and the cross-matching that we'll see. I would imagine it's going to be Jason Tatum on Karl-Anthony Towns. I would imagine we get, I guess, who guards Jalen Brunson would be a question that I would have, because it largely, at least in terms of initial matchups,
everybody,
like Derrick White. We've seen some Jordan Walsh. We've seen some Jaylen Brown.
And so, everybody.
That is true. That is fair. And so, like, how do they want to balance off of that? And then for Boston's offense, are they able to poke at New York's defense in a way, poke at matchups in a way where they don't bog down? Because I think as the series has gone on against Philadelphia in particular, some of the mismatch hunting and just some of the overall tempo for Boston has felt slow. And if you have slow tempo, in addition to the three-point shot isn't falling to the same way because you aren't generating the same looks, this is how Boston historically has gotten in trouble during their postseason series. That's a part of why we are heading into a game 7 on Saturday to begin with, because of the offense drying up a little bit, some of the tempo drying up a little bit. And so they would have to make sure they don't fall into that same trap against the New York Knicks if that ends up being the matchup. But I am excited for this game 7. I think regardless of who wins, they pose some interesting challenges to the New York Knicks and vice versa. So I'm excited to see what that is going to look like. All right, Steve, we got some game 6s happening later today. We'll go quick. We have the Lakers and the Rockets. No Kevin Durant once again for the Houston Rockets. Rockets coming off a 6-point win. Do we think this series goes to 7? How concerned are you about the Lakers based on what the last couple of games have been?
I mean, I'm not concerned. This is just the battle of a playoff series. The Lakers showcased their formula as far as being able to defend at a high level, show help, bother the Rockets, bog them down, and have a blend offensively. The Rockets, once they lost Kevin Durant, responded with, we're just going to have to get everyone involved. And so, Amen Thompson, you attack some matchups, you get involved in pick and roll. Reed Shepard, you hunt and pick and roll. Alperen Şengün, you're going to have to be aggressive. Jabari, you play off ball and get some cuts and find your pockets. And then defensively, we have to get after it to a high level. So as I mentioned last week, this is where, who's going to get it done? The Lakers know exactly what their pathway to victory is. They just need one more win. And so can they get back to their blend of off-ball movement? Can they get back to LeBron winning matchups? Can Austin Reeves elevate them offensively? Can Luke Kennard and Mark Smart put pressure on them? Can they put Reed Shepard in action? And can they keep that defense at a high level to bother the Rockets? If the Rockets are going to be able to defend the Lakers at a certain level and then have some tempo on the other end where we're a little unpredictable, we're getting to different actions, they showcase that will give them a level of success. If you're the Lakers, okay, we have to take something off of this board right now. And so if they can take something off the board, I think they find themselves in a position where they advance in this series. Houston's very confident. You got to poke at that. Alperen Şengün called a shot, said we're coming back to L.A., so we'll see what happens. But I think this is where, again, elimination games are weird. And so can Lakers just find 48 minutes of enough? Because DeAndre Ayton played well. Can we get this done now? Can we get Houston not scoring and absolve ourselves from the series? That's the intrigue for me.
I got you. Can I ask you a Şengün related question really quickly?
Sure.
How much pressure would you like to see, or maybe not pressure, as more specifically helps and doubles? How often would you like to see the Lakers send two to Alperen Şengün in game 6 and or game 7?
Well, I mean, if he's going to be the hub, so you have to get him back to the box you had him in the first two games, as far as making him think about the game as opposed to playing the game and pushing his catches out and showing random help, whether it be from the baseline or it be from the elbow or it be a hard double to where you're not necessarily sure what we're going to do. And we're going to make you tween hezzy from the 3-point line as opposed from the elbow. So you just need to get him out of aggressive mode that he's been in. He's been really good as far as attacking in these last few games from Houston, and get him back into what you had in the first two games where you're thinking about what we're doing. And that's good for us, because now we're able to rotate and recover. So I think that's the most important thing. It's not necessarily the volume of it. It's just, can you time it well enough to where he's unsure and now uncertain of when to attack?
Okay, I think that's fair. I wanted to get your thoughts on that quickly. I think for me, I've been, like, aside from game one, I've been pretty impressed with what Houston has looked like defensively. The Lakers have turned the ball over quite a bit, pretty much this entire series, even in that game one where they lit things up and Luke Kennard was incredible. Them shifting Amen Thompson onto Luke Kennard, going Jabari Smith Jr. on Marcus Smart, and just leaning further into the switching, in addition to already the physicality that they're bringing defensively. The Lakers have not had a good time trying to poke at Houston's defense. So I'm curious to see, like, what part of that flips. Are they more intentional about getting Luke Kennard going off the ball, to your earlier point? Is that a way to kind of loosen things? Because otherwise, I am fascinated by how the Lakers are going to create consistently headed moving forward. I think that's where you're starting to see a lot of this confidence grow for Houston, because, like, they have LA's half-court offense back in the box. They're able to run a little bit more in transition. You're seeing more flow, as you mentioned already, in the half-court and different guys attacking different matchups. Can the Lakers find the way to ding that defense, and to your point about Şengün, like, make him a little bit more uncomfortable? Like, I'm curious to see what that part is going to look like. And just a general get well soon to Kevin Durant. I know he's been working hard to get back, but don't know if we're going to see him. We move to the Eastern Conference. The Cleveland Cavaliers, pivotal game 5 victory over the Toronto Raptors. In that game 5, though, Brandon Ingram left early with a heel injury. Scottie Barnes got hit in the quad, did play in the second half, said he's going to be good for game 6. So baseline question is just, like, how healthy are the Raptors going to be? Within that, how concerned are you about Toronto being able to tie this up and or win this series in light of some of the health stuff?
I think it'll be an active crowd. I think the tough part for Toronto is they have a specific formula to win. They have held Donovan Mitchell and James Harden to a particular level of play over 2 or 3 games. And now if they explode like they did in the first two games, does it matter? And so to go quick, like, I don't think Toronto is necessarily in danger. I think they're in an elimination game scenario where I think they could really bother Cleveland and push this, but Cleveland could tap some right buttons. And now we saw Dennis Schroeder have an impact the last game. All they need is one person to go off or their best players to play well. And now, okay, we've poked at your defense. We feel more comfortable with Scottie Barnes and Brandon Ingram. Qu'est-ce que c'est? So that's where Cleveland could get this done.
I just hope Brandon Ingram's all right. It certainly explained, like, what the first half of that game 5 looked like for him, or just what the last couple of games looked like in terms of aggressiveness, explosiveness, et cetera. And so I'm curious to see if he's going to be good to go. Was also intrigued, Max Strus is entering the starting lineup in that game 5 for Cleveland, trying to juice the offense. So we'll see if they stick with that moving forward. But yeah, if the stars are banged up, and what I saw in that second half or fourth quarter of game 5, where Evan Mobley really got going, was really aggressive, getting downhill, et cetera. If the paint battle swings has swung in any real way, like that just feels problematic for Toronto. But we are fresh off of Jacoby Walter knocking down what felt like every three that he took. Jamal Shedd has had his moments in this game. So, like, they can absolutely just get the random role player piece, plus Scotty Barnes feeling better. RJ Barrett, who's just been really good in this series overall. He continues to drive, get downhill, poke at James Harden and others in matchups. Pathway is there. I am a little bit concerned about what this offense is going to look like, though. No Brandon Ingram plus Scotty being hindered. I have my concerns. So we will see what that looks like later. And finally, we have the Orlando Magic still up 3-2, but the Detroit Pistons, what a duel it was between Cade Cunningham and Paolo Banchero in that one. 45 for Cade, 45 for Paolo in that one as well. Still, I would imagine we still see no Franz Wagner in this one. Heading into the game six, how concerned are you about Orlando with no Franz in this one? Do you believe Detroit has the gumption to come back in this one with Franz out?
It's not about concern in this series. It's about a fight. The door is closed. There's no escape from the cage. Someone has to come out the winner. And this is what it's about. So the second time that we've seen two players score 45 or more in a playoff duel was Paolo and Cade. And that's real playoff hoops. And it reminded me of 14-year-old Steve watching Vince Carter and Allen Iverson. And this is what playoff basketball can be about. And so everything is pretty clear about the battleground of this series. And I think the interesting part, obviously, was Cade not just scoring, but boy, Orlando was really forced to put two on the ball in some scenarios they hadn't done previously in the series, where it's like, oh, guard screen, two on the ball. Pick and roll, we're up at the level. Jalen Duren's now rolling. So how much are they going to mix that in over the course? And that does that unlock things for Detroit to a different degree? Can they now become a different team? For Orlando, they are in this scenario. They know exactly how they have to win these games. Then back in their home arena, which is not an easy place to win in the playoffs. We have to defend at a high enough level. Paolo Banchero has been game. And all of you, every single one of you, every single one of you should be ashamed of yourselves for how you talked about Paolo Banchero this series. Including you. You should. But he's been game as far as getting the buckets that they need in this playoff series. So can we get enough defense? Can we get enough irrational confidence to get buckets? And can we just get out of here? Can we escape and erase the memory of Tracy McGrady and the 3-1 lead they had on the Detroit Pistons? Is that what we can do?
Oh, dear. They're going to need to. I don't know if anybody wants to relive that one. But on the Paolo front, great series for him overall. Again, coming off of that 45, 9, and 7 for Paolo in that one. I think you take any 6 of 11 from 3 game you can get from Paolo on that front. So, as you mentioned, the battleground's already done, or established, rather. And so whose defense can set the tone? We are fresh off of some random role player pieces to advance. We just watched the Minnesota game. Do we get another Jamal Cain game? Do we get an Anthony Black game? We'll see who pops for Orlando if they're able to get this one done. A little bit worried with how comfortable Kay is looking in this one, though. So we shall see. We are now going to take a break. And when we return, we shift to the W side. We got some debuts. We finally got to see the Wings. We got to see Angel Reese in a dream uniform. We talk about what we saw. Stick with us.
Check out Yahoo Sports coverage of the Miami Grand Prix starting this weekend. You can watch F1 practice and qualifying coverage for free on yahoosports.com and the Yahoo Sports app. Free practice one begins at noon Eastern time on Friday, May 1st, while qualifying takes place at 4 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday, May 2nd. The Miami Grand Prix will stream on Apple TV at 4 p.m. Sunday, May the 3rd. Check it all out at yahoosports.com/racing. You don't want to miss out.
And we're back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. Time to shift to the W. More preseason action has been played. I think all 15 have played at this point in terms of the teams. We got a new look at the Dallas Wings, Steve. Didn't get the full assortment. No Arike Ogunbowale, no Jessica Shepherd yet. A lot of overseas commitments. But Paige Beckers is back. AZ Foot debut. We got more Caitlin Clark from the Fever side. A 95-80 victory for the Dallas Wings. So, Steve, we finally got a chance to look at the Dallas Wings with AZ Foot. What were some of your early impressions of this one?
Well, I mean, let's just have a conversation. You know, I think it's important to understand if you thought the Wings were going to have growth, having a new coach, having a stronger roster, it's easy to underrate Paige Bueckers just getting better and what that means for the Dallas Wings overall. And so if this is a team that can have a little bit more versatility defensively, have a little bit more lineup versatility, and have Paige be able to be moved around the board to this degree and attack in different areas of the court, and okay, we can get off-ball movement, we can get post-ups, we can get pick and roll, I think that changes the equation a little bit. And so I think for me, the conversation starts with, how do you feel about the Dallas Wings with Paige being used in this way, having more personnel in certain areas? Do you feel better about them based on your expectations? Because it appeared like, it seemed like you were very concerned about what you heard from the Dallas Wings in the preseason. So I'm curious to see if anything's changed based on their performance.
I was intrigued by what this opener was against the Fever. Like, you take the win, but like more than anything, is just what is the process going to be like? I think if you're going three guard with AZ kind of as your nominal three, and you're adding another guard in here, Odyssey Sims got to start for Dallas and this with Arike out. Them being able to unlock Paige Bueckers even more off the ball is super intriguing to me. And the fact that they can get into this side-to-side flow where you may kick something off with AZ Fudge, she comes off the flare, you float to the other side, get into a two-player action. If it works, great. If it doesn't, we go to the other side. Now it's maybe Paige. Maybe now it's Odyssey Sims. Now it's the bigs making decisions. The fact that they have this level of optionality within their offense and what they were able to display in that opener against Indiana, that intrigues me. And I think even as I was asking Jose Fernandez...
No, wait. I didn't mean to cut you off, but remember, Jose Fernandez was very clear. They got to guard us, too. He didn't say that for no reason. I just want to throw it out there. They have to guard us, too. Everyone talks about what we're going to do defensively. They got to guard us, too. So just remember that. I know it was an answer you didn't like, but continue with your rant.
No rant needed, but that's where a lot of my early intrigue went to. And so watching how they use Paige off the ball, watching how they used AZ Fudd off the ball was a lot of fun. And I think you're going to have to continue to build on that, what the timing is going to be when you have AZ coming off some of those flares. Like, one of the funnier possessions that I saw in that game, I want to say it was in the second half, Paige initiating, they were going into just pass it back, AZ come off a flare. And so Paige is trying to throw this lead pass to AZ in space, and Alanna Smith, I guess, thought it was like an errant pass, and she just catches it. And then they flow to a two-player action from there. I was like, oh, that's funny. They're going to learn. Paige wants to throw that in space, let AZ run into it. She can attack from there. So that one made me laugh. But just in general, I like the way that they would kind of build that out and structure it. Defensively, the brow still a little bit raised. I was not anticipating as much like high pickup points or high ball pressure in light of what the personnel was. It made sense because you are dealing with Caitlin Clark and you do just want to have hands on her. But like, looking at some of the early reps in particular, like a lot of early drives, high screens, we get downhill. Paige got beat on one. AZ got beat on one. So it's just like, okay, how do you kind of find that balance on things like that? And so I still want to know, like, how are they going to sprinkle in the defense? Like, how much active do they want the bigs to be in terms of the assignments? How are we doling that out? Paige just guarding Caitlin outright was interesting to me because I was kind of anticipating, is she going to be kind of off, you know, defending more threes because of the strength? Loses some, you know, lessens some of the load because of what she does offensively, et cetera. So her just taking Caitlin outright was interesting to me. But yeah, so still just keeping an eye on how they're going to build the defense out. But to your point, to Jose Fernandez's point, hey, we are going to be tough to deal with. And if this is going to be the optionality and the pace that they play with offensively, then yeah, they are going to put teams in a headlock with the way that they play and the way that they flow. So very impressive, maybe.
Yeah, so it appears the rant was needed. But I think to add to what you're saying, it's interesting to see how Dallas builds this out defensively. Alanna Smith does so many things defensively. What does that look like in this context? And I think there were moments where there were like back cuts or drives, and Alanna Smith nailed the rotation, only the Dallas Wings got beat quick. And so she was in position, but needed a heartbeat to get to where it does. So does... My concern is, how much does she elevate this defense based on where this defense was? And so I am intrigued by how that fits. And like, I think with Alanna Smith in Minnesota, you had the locked in defensive nature. And then, okay, you in particular said, hey, are the shots going to be made? But now is there going to be more of an adventure to where offensively we don't necessarily need you or use you as much in the defense? You are doing what you're supposed to do, but we're not as strong as that team was. So it doesn't feel the same way. And so that part gets intriguing to me. I think AZ Fudd's activity was good to see. And so I think there's, again, more potential for her defensively. I'm intrigued to see again how they build this out. And I think there's some juice there off the bounce. I don't know if they're going to necessarily tap the button and say, here are these pick and rolls to these handoffs, but the aggression was good. Maddie Segrist has had absolutely bucket. Enough. And like reminding people of what she can provide for a team. And so I think that's very interesting. To the Fever side, you're going to have to deal with Caitlin Clark this year. Everyone's going to have to deal mm-hmm. with Caitlin Clark this year. And it's pretty apparent. Not only would I like to drive the basketball, I have a little bit more of an in-between game. I'm going to initiate contact. And I can also get back to the step back. And I think the biggest thing is the force that she's played with in the preseason stands out to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the mixture of, okay, we're going to get you some pass and catch. We're going to play at a high tempo. We're going to play pick and roll. I think everyone needs to raise an eyebrow about how old CeCe's been playing in the preseason.
No, I think that's more than fair. 21 points in 16 minutes in this one. The drives hit. I think even if you saw in the preseason opener for Indiana, like immediately starts with a mid-range shot in some of the creation inside the arc. So her showcasing more proficiency there, being able to get to the line a little bit more, certainly got to the line in this one against Dallas. But I think that downhill force is kind of like the last thing, quote unquote, missing for her. Because I think if you are broadening the scope for this Fever offense and the desire to get Caitlin off ball a little bit more, let Kelsey initiate, let Raven Johnson, another good game for Raven Johnson, by the way, let her initiate. Let's see if we can get some stuff in for Caitlin, make life a little bit easier for her. If she's getting more catch and shoot threes, if she's more comfortable operating in the mid-range, if the drives continue to hit and the foul drawing perks up, and then you have self-creation stuff on top of that, and the transition attacks and passes on top of all of that, she's already lethal offensively. It kind of, for me, it kind of lessens the impact, or not the impact, but like lessens the need for like the off-the-bounce three to be as much of a weapon if everything else grows the way that we've seen it showcase over these first couple of games. And then that feels like more of a bonus to me. And that makes life more difficult. And with Caitlin looking like this, remember, we have not seen her plus Aaliyah Boston yet, as they're being conservative with the Aaliyah Boston injury. Once they come back together, and now you're just introducing all of the two-player actions between those two. You get the Aaliyah post-ups. You get the Aaliyah hub work. You get the empty side pick and rolls with Aaliyah and Caitlin. If teams are going full court pressure with Caitlin, with her breaking it up, Aaliyah setting a screen at half court and rolling and being more comfortable putting the ball on the floor and flowing into different things, it gets so much more interesting for Indiana's offense. That was already good. It should be even better. And Aaliyah being back should just help the defense overall.
No, I'm right there with you. I think, obviously, Fever didn't have the success they wanted in this preseason game, but if we're talking about teams that have tried to build on like continuity, the Fever feeling comfortable with what they've built and what they can add to it, it's mm-hmm. they're one of the teams where I'm like, if I look at the starting line and teams that may have a sprint at the start, you know, we're probably talking Aces, Liberty, Fever, Dream to a degree, right? If the Fever get off to the start they need to get to, I think things can get very interesting. So just want to throw it out there.
Yeah, I think it's going to be similar to conversations we had heading into last season, honestly, where it's like, this is a lot of talent. They add some quality role players on top of this. If the young core continues to grow, like, this could be a danger group. And they just got hit with all sorts of injuries and still almost made the finals last year. So a healthier slash better Caitlin on top of all of this. The Fever should not be discounted in these conversations. We'll do more preview things moving forward since the regular season. Starting next week, Steve, we are very close. But interesting stuff shown from the Indiana Fever. More playoff, more preseason action coming their way over the weekend. We now move to the Atlanta Dream taking on Chicago Sky. The first Angel Reese return game, not in the regular season yet, but a return game nonetheless. The Dream able to get an 87-78 victory in this one. Mostly saw the starters in the first half, a little sprinkling in the third quarter. But Angel Reese, 8.7 rebounds, 2 assists, 3 steals, and about 13 minutes of action for the Atlanta Dream. So, Steve, I'll toss it to you. How did you see her slide in to what the Atlanta Dream wanted to do? Did it meet your expectations? Was it different from what you expected with her usage? Like, how did you feel about the debut?
No, it wasn't different. I think with what the Atlanta Dream have built contextually on offense and defense, it was just more, okay, what does Angel Reese look like within it? As opposed to placing all the pressure on, will Angel Reese elevate this in a preseason game? And so I think what I liked from Angel Reese was some of the work when she was spaced as far as trying to set like an off-ball screen or a flare, the mm-hmm. solid work in pick and roll. And so being able to kind of work Angel Reese in within the flow of what the Dream do, I think getting her some more sudden pick and rolls where, okay, it's a swing. I pick and roll. I stay in the pocket. Had a really nice job where she saw the defense want to keep on the side, got in the middle of the floor, right hand drive, right hand finish. That's where you want to see, okay, I think we can elevate Angel Reese, but also she can help us as far as what we've built on before, having a big who can screen, having a big who can be active, having a big who can kind of space the floor. And so it was interesting to watch her, the attempts, as far as a lot of right-hand drives, a lot of I'll take this shot out here. And so I'm more tracking the growth for Angel within Atlanta as opposed to placing all the immediate pressure on, well, Angel has to be this for Atlanta to be this. Atlanta's a good team. And so I think it's just we have bigs that work in this context. I think Angel can elevate that. The defense was interesting. I think the drop reps are pretty good as far as the activity goes. And I can be close to the level. I can drop back a little bit. I could stay in the pocket. And so keeping an eye on that. But I think it was just a good first swing of the bat. If you're Angel Reese in the Atlanta Dream, what did you think?
I think for me, like, based on what I expected, it was certainly a little bit different. Like, it was a lot more fitting in and sliding into the system more than I am empowering Angel to grab and go. She's going to initiate a bunch of stuff. She's going to execute a bunch of handoffs. We're going to see a bunch of inverted pick and rolls. It was less that. It was a lot more of Angel being spaced and just kind of getting in where she fit in. I don't think that is inherently bad, to be clear. Just answering, like, what my expectations were based on what we actually saw. I'm glad that you hit on the off-ball screening portion, because that was one of the first things I wanted to talk about with the Angel off-ball experience. Because naturally, you think about Angel Reese spacing in this environment, and your mind probably goes to, well, this is a team that wants to get up a whole bunch of threes. Carlos Mesco in the introductory press talked about, hey, we're going to empower her to take these, et cetera. What are the three-point attempts? What are the volumes going to look like? And I was more intrigued by, let's set these pin-ins. Let's set these flare. There was one possession early in the game where she was going to set a screen, and the ball went to her anywhere. She's like, oh, snap, I got this. Hurried up and grabbed it. Tossed it back to Ryan Howard, who took a three in the left corner. I think she made it. But it's just like, it's a funny moment. It's preseason time. They're trying to get their flow and timing together. But it's like, okay, if this is going to be a bigger part of the offense, that's an easy way to alleviate teams that may be like, okay, I don't care if Angel takes three or four threes a game because she's not making 40% of them yet. If Angel's going to be an active off-ball screener in addition to the pick-and-roll work, that makes it a little bit more difficult to deal with. And because she can put the ball on the deck, it's not like you can ignore her completely, because she can get downhill and attack and get to the free throw line, or she can just dribble into these kind of pitches and handoffs and flow into two-player actions from there. And so, like, I was, again, a little surprised with the volume of, like, on-ball usage, off-ball usage, et cetera. But, like, the actual ideas and concepts, I was pretty pleased with. Defensively, also on the drop reps, like, this is a question that I tossed to you heading into Atlanta's preseason opener. Like, hey, Bree Jones is down. How often are we going to see them in a drop versus something more activity-based, or if they're going to lean more into switching? They pretty much doubled down on what they were doing last year. Like, no, we're going to be in a drop. Like, we'll let Angel creep up, get up to touch, and then drop back if necessary. Got a nice steal on a pocket pass. Insane over the, I think J.C. Sheldon tossing the over-the-head pass. Angel's able to steal that one. And so you got positive reps there, and this is why I was excited for her getting those reps at the five during Team USA play. So I was anticipating more so for Chicago than Atlanta. But, okay, she's going to need to be able to do more of that. And so getting those positive reps, I think, it intrigued me for sure. Also, Bedina Okot, just want to quickly say, double-double off the bench. She moves so well for someone her size. And, again, I am curious to see, like, what her regular season usage is going to look like while Bree Jones recovers. Like, I don't know what the minute load is going to be like. Very well pleased with what the debut was for her on that front. But, yeah, so slightly different expectation-wise, but I did enjoy the Angel debut. In general, did anyone else pop for you in this Sky Dream game? Sky Dream game.
Borlase popped for me. Get some cutting, get some drives, get some spacing, get some aggression. Love that. Shout out to Australia. I think Haley Van Lith's decisiveness popped to me. As far as I am going to look to make a play, I will seek contact. I will get after it. Gabriela Jaquez intrigues me. I think the handle is stronger than some people expected. And so I don't necessarily think that's going to be like massive pick and roll reps, but like there's a comfort there. There's a comfort cutting. There's a comfort defending. I think for the Sky, it's okay. Can we nail down what you want to do? One, you got to stop turning the ball over in the most random ways possible.
Probably yes, please.
But I think there's a lot of potential there. And again, they have vets that have not or did not play. So, okay, can we get a mix of building on different things and have a concept of what we want to do? Or I think it felt like they were searching at times. So I think for the Sky, I remain intrigued by this team because you get Rekia Jackson playing a certain way. Kamilla is still going to get a double in the post if you get certain matchups or certain roles. Rachel Banham feels a lot more comfortable not having to be a point guard and saying, actually, I will just let it fly. This is fantastic and fun for me. You got J.C. Sheldon trying to work defensively and attack downhill. Like, they have a lot of pieces. Can they just put the puzzle together? I'm bad at doing puzzles, so I understand what that preseason game felt like, but like, I'm intrigued by the talent they have there, especially when you are deciding, okay. Hey, Skylar Diggins, Courtney Vandersloot, Dejounte Carrington, come on down. Like, that's Azaray Stevens. Come, like, there's a lot of other things that can help elevate this team to where we can kind of knock on some doors.
Yeah, I think part of the turnovers going down for Chicago moving forward is just going to be we have some of our talent coming back. We have Skylar initiating more of these ball screens, just initiating more offense. We have Courtney Vandersloot caretaking whenever she makes a return versus I think clearly JC and Kamilla are trying to build their pick and roll chemistry still. Like, even to that earlier steal that I mentioned from Angel, I'm just kind of looking at that rope like, ooh, well, here's just a very wide pocket pass window. JC's like, let me toss this over the top. And it's like, well, maybe that wasn't the time for that one. But, like, still trying to figure that portion out. I think for me, if we're going Chicago intrigue first, because I do have some starter thoughts, Sidney Taylor better be on somebody's roster by the time the regular season rolls around. That could be a standard contract in Chicago. That could be a developmental contract in Chicago. That could be someone else, if she does not stick in Chicago, getting her a standard contract or development spot. I like the way Sidney Taylor plays basketball. Like, there is a level of pacing and shiftiness that she has offensively that pops. I think part of why Haley Van Lith has looked so comfortable in these two games offensively is, like, one, the Sky overall have done such a good job of setting up Haley's touches to make sure she's getting the ball on the move so she can get downhill and then layer that contact in to be a little bit more aggressive. I think having someone like Sidney that can get downhill certainly helps in that regard. But watching her fly around the transition, watching her move off the ball, watching her get after it defensively, like, she has probably been my favorite part of the Chicago preseason experience through two games. Again, it is two games, so don't want to overact too much. But she very much feels like a W player to me in some capacity. Someone needs to take the flyer. I've just been impressed with what it's looked like on both ends of the floor. So I think I start there with, like, what intrigued me in this game and even just zooming out with Chicago. Beyond that, though, how they're mixing in the Rekia Jackson usage. Go ahead.
Continue. Keep an eye on the clock.
All right. I just want to say, like, how they mix in the Rekia Jackson usage, how much of this is going to be ISO, handoff, pick and roll, post ups, what that part's going to look like, what her two-player chemistry, Kamilla Carlos, is going to look like. Continue to see that build and see that chemistry build. That's going to be fun. Love that you mentioned what Rachel Banham has looked like, just the overall aggression for her off the ball. I think Chicago's going to need that. Kamilla, I'm not going to hang here too long. I just want better screening for Kamilla. This isn't new for me. I think when you see the positive reps, she's able to force over. She's able to suck in the defense. You see some of the late switches, her being able to seal and draw fouls in that regard. When she does not nail it, it makes life a little bit more difficult on her guards, and you want to see more consistently defensively. So, quick note on the Kamilla front, but again, we have plenty of time to see what else happens on the Chicago front. But that is where I would leave it. We did have three more games on Wednesday, Steve. And so I want to open the floor.
We sure did. We don't have to open the floor. We have a limited time, so you tell me what popped for you, and when I see something, I will interrupt you. So go ahead. What you got? Sun Temple.
Okay.
What stood out to you, big dog?
Hoo-wee. So one, broader strokes, this Connecticut Sun defense is fun. And they don't have size. Their full assortment there.
They got size. That's a big team right there as far as having activity and some wings and some length. That's a fun team. Continue.
Yes, sir. So being able to mix in, we're going to have our bigs at the level. You don't know if we're going to switch or not. We can just switch 1-3 or 1-4, depending on what the lineups are. Toronto certainly had to search to find some openings. And that led to, like, some later thoughts. I ended up threading some things on Kiki Rice as she made her debut for the Toronto Tempo. And one of the things I noted was, like, hey, she is getting off this ball a little quicker than I would like. She has a little bit more room to explore in the intermediate areas that she may be giving herself credit for. But a lot of that is just a testament to what Connecticut's defense looked like. We're sprinkling in some nail help. We're sprinkling in some digs. So these reads aren't clear cut for you. And so, like, I felt like it was a good opening challenge for her to kind of see that kind of defense, see that kind of length, see that kind of activity. So that part was interesting. But just overall, like, Connecticut defending the way they did, especially when they had their regulars in, that was a lot of fun. The aggression from Anissa Morrow in this one, the aggression from Aaliyah Edwards in this one. And obviously you're going to be able to sprinkle in the BG post-ups and things. Like, their bigs are going to be very annoying to play against this year, regardless of what the win-loss record is actually going to be. That is a collection of talent that is going to be annoying to see on random nights. So that part was fun. And again, didn't have their full assortment. I'm excited to see Layla Lacan at some point. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to your point that the Sun will be an annoying team to play against because you have to deal with bigs. You can go side to side. Brittany Griner could be a hub for them. So I was trying to get in and also add that. But continue, guys.
Okay. But no, that was just what I briefly had on the Sun front. And then for the tempo again, like how they're going to navigate their offense, what the point guard reps look like. Shout out to Kia Nurse very quickly. First official basket in Toronto tempo history. Of course, it is going to be a three-pointer. And of course, it is going to come from Kia Nurse. So I want to give her the salute on that front. We saw elements of aggression from Lexi Held in Phoenix. We sprinkle in these drives. We knock down these shots. Again, can do the hub work stuff with Alyssa Thomas when their minutes match. For her to just have more of a green light in this one, you get to see an even higher volume of the drives. That was a lot of fun for me. Like, I don't think it's going to be 21 points a night. But, like, that part was intriguing to me and how they mixed in the on-ball touches, how they set up some of those with the screening. I think, in general, the tempo trying to mix in, we are going to flare away. We're going to make sure when we go side to side, it's going to be some sort of off-ball screen to set up these touches. I think it's smart. Again, Connecticut defended well, but conceptually, I do like that.
Well, let's about the tempo. I think they have a lot of versatility they can tap into over the course of the season, especially when you have the bucket getting of Marina Mabry and Brittany Sykes and the aggression they bring. How much will the defense pop? I think they want to establish that very clearly, but I think they have some lineup versatility and they're going to have some players that can make plays, put the ball on the floor, and there's some lineups they can throw out there that are going to be interesting. So I think I wish I could have seen the full tempo experience. I could really grasp what Sandy is trying to do for this team, but I liked what I saw as far as the different abilities to have double big lineups, a little bit smaller lineups, having spacing on the floor, looking to attack. And so I thought that was intriguing from the tempo. And I think they are set up to try and establish themselves quicker than, like, it's not going to be Golden State-esque, but it's like, well, Golden State laid the pathway. Why can't we do it as well? So I'm intrigued to see how Toronto grows and what their start looks like at the sprint, what their sprint looks like at the start of the season.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Quickly, as we go to Storm Fire, one, Flaje Johnson continues to be incredibly fun, and I continue to enjoy how the Storm are setting up her touches and getting her the ball on the move. Like, the left-hand stuff that people talked about pre-draft doesn't really matter as much if she's just able to get to her right because she is curling off of a screen and she is so explosive she can just get to her spot before you can think about it. So, like, that part's been fun. Structurally, this was a fun matchup for me because one of the things I noted early on for Seattle, because I look at them defensively, it's like, ooh, this is a whole lot of nail help. These are a lot of digs from the wings. We're going to be super aggressive. You get this first matchup against the Portland Fire. It's like, hey, how about we clear the wings every other possession? You're actually not going to be able to do that. And so for the way they were able to kind of clear space was interesting to me. And the way they empowered the guards, empowered the bigs for that matter, I was super intrigued by Emily Inksler just being on this roster in general. And talked about this ahead of the expansion draft. Like, who signs her? Is anyone able to, like, unleash her and let her do more things on the ball? I liked her usage in this basketball game as a screener, handoff hub. They let her drive a little bit. She got to do a lot of fun things. I loved how Portland spaced in this one. And I think it was just a fun back and forth battle between those two. What popped for you in this one?
A lot. I think the Storm, it's a land of opportunity for their guards. I think a lot of their guards feel empowered by what their coach has done with them. And so you saw Zaya Cook have a rep as far as, like, I get a hard show, I dribble away from it, I hit the roller. That's good stuff. Flaje has looked very good as far as being aggressive on the offensive end. Lexi Brown's felt comfortable. Like, their guard room has felt good. And I think the more confidence they have, the better. I think the Storm have a lot of versatility they can tap into, especially when they get their full team, where we can just have a lot of tall people do different things. And we have bigs who can keep things moving. We have guards in place. So I'm intrigued how the Storm build on this. The Fire really intrigued me because I think there was a building intentionality of who they wanted to do. I don't know how clean it's going to be the start for the Fire, but they're clearly building something as far as having the ability to space the floor and have some real intentional cuts with what they do offensively. Yes. And so running pistol action and having someone rise from the block to the wing, having a pop from the wing to the top of the key, having a cut from the wing, empty side pick and roll, wheel action as far as a corner cut, wing slides down, but it's not every time. It might be a flare. They might mix that in. And so I think as the Fire get more reps, they're going to put themselves in a position to grow. And so my goal for the Fire is just like get better every single day, because you're trying to build something that's not rigid. It will take reading. And so as I watch them do different things, it's like, ooh, okay, can defenses lock in on this? Potentially, but they don't do the same thing every single time. So I think the goal is to avoid being rigid, putting yourself in a position to make reads and make plays, and going over the top of that. And so while I'm concerned, like the Fire, it was real back and forth in that Firestorm game as far as both teams getting up and down the floor. But okay, can the Fire nail down the points? And I think the other part about the Fire is they got a lot of players who have an opportunity to really just be empowered. So if we're talking about Carla Late being aggressive, we're talking about Sarah Ashley Barker, we're talking about Haley Jones, we're talking about Megan Gustafson, we're talking about Louisa. Like, there's a lot of players who can just go, Emily Inkson, who can go out there and I can make reads, I can make plays, I can be myself. And it's not necessarily on me to make this specific play. I just got to play basketball. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the Bridget Carlton part gets interesting to me. So I'm sure a lot of people will look at the salary and be like, PU, right? But how much growth does Bridget Carlton really have within this team? Or can she elevate them just by being herself, being smart, making reads, making plays, spacing the floor? I am intrigued to see what that looks like. So that's my Fire take.
Very good. I like it. Just that overall empowerment. Again, the spacing constructs really intrigue me on the Portland side. And just a quick salute to the Phoenix Mercury, an 86-60 win over the Japanese national team. Triple-double watch for Alyssa Thomas in this one. Kalia Copper continues to let it fly. This is going to be a fun bounce-back year for Kalia Copper. Not going to hang here too long. We're deep in the pot. But, hey, man, I am excited. Watching her and Alyssa Thomas in action together has been a lot of fun. Watching her hunt these pull-up threes in particular. You already know the transition drives are going to be there. I don't know. I'm seeing, you know, people want to do their early power rankings and things. I'm sure we'll do something of the sort over the next couple of weeks. The Phoenix Mercury are just going to be a good basketball team. I'm sorry. Like, I'll hold the L if I need to. This is still going to be a good team when you have those two and they're able to play off each other in that way, if they're able to defend in that way. I'm intrigued and excited still about the Phoenix Mercury. That's all I got on that.
Understood. I think they tap in continuity. They can have an early start. That's great. And they've, once again, hidden people that we don't know about in the preseason. I don't trust them. I'll wait till the regular season. So, Nikias, would you like to send us home and get us out of here?
I sure would. Oh, quickly, get well soon, Cat Westbelt, out for the year with a torn ACL while we're talking Phoenix Mercury. So we'll see what happens with the backup big room there. But beyond that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main YouTube channel if you haven't already. That's where our W stuff is going. If you are more of a YouTube consumer of the podcast, you can follow me on socials at NikiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at SteveJones20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.